Welcome to the January 2012 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinchem. The January issue is on the topic of focused ultrasound. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Jeff Elias of the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, speaks with Dr. Daniel Jaminaud of the Center of Ultrasound Functional Neurosurgery in Solothurn, Switzerland. They discuss Dr. Jaminaud and colleagues' article, Transcranial MR-Guided Focused Ultrasound, Non-Invasive Central Lateral Thalamotomy Against Chronic Neuropathic Pain.
I'd like to welcome our listeners to the January 2012 issue of Neurosurgical Focus, our podcast version. This issue is devoted to a new topic of focused ultrasound surgery and its applications in the central nervous system. And we're very pleased today to have Professor Daniel Jaminaud of Solothurn University. Dr. Jaminaud is a professor of neurosurgery at the University of Zurich, and he also is an adjunct professor of neuroscience and physiology at New York University. Thank you for talking to us today, Dr. Jaminaud.
A great pleasure, Dr. Elias, to be with you tonight.
I'd like to congratulate you on a wonderful article for this month's issue of Neurosurgical Focus. For those listeners who are joining in today, we're specifically talking about transcranial MR-guided focus ultrasound surgery for chronic neuropathic pain. This is a manuscript which is addressing a procedure that you have a lot of experience with, which is a central lateral thalamotomy. For those of our listeners who are not very familiar with this new technology, can you describe it for us?
Yes, with pleasure. For many years, it has been tried to be able to use ultrasound therapeutically in many body parts, and especially in the brain. But obviously, the presence of the skull had given a big challenge for technology. And also the necessity to have the possibility to image what is being done is obviously also another very important dimension. In recent times, in the last few years, these possibilities have increased and, in fact, concentrate on these different factors. First, the possibility to use the focusing principle, meaning to put a certain number, as high as possible, of, in that case, waves that would then all go through the bone in different places, but all converge inside a focal point or inside the target, allowing us to redistribute the energy delivery to the bone or many places. The idea is to finally reach focal points of small dimension in the millimeter domain with sharp delineation and very precise placement inside the millimeter. For this, it was necessary to first have generators or sources of ultrasound of enough intensity, it's called high intensity, and also to integrate then the density and thickness of the bone in each penetration point to be able to pre-correct all the waves so that they all converge in the target. This, I think, would be the main elements that had to be realized, and we are lucky enough to have these elements at hand. The group of physicists and engineers in Haifa in Israel, in the company Insightec, have provided immense advances in this field until today.
So ultrasound technology has been used for quite some time, I guess, for diagnostic and therapeutic applications in the body. Now we have the ability to use it in the brain. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And how did you learn about this technology? Because you're really a real pioneer in the use of this technology in the human brain.
Yes. But initially, as I was still working in Zurich, I was contacted by Professor Martin, a neuroradiologist, a pediatric neuroradiologist, who had heard about the technology, and we decided to join efforts and apply this new development to the field of functional neurosurgery, which is my and your field too. The reasons to choose this field are that this field gives to the system not such a strong demand. The targets we have to explore and realize are small, and they are central inside the skull volume, so the demand is not so great. For example, tumors that are extended and much larger pose additional technological challenges. So it was a good area to start with. So we developed a project supported by the Swiss National Science Foundation, and were able between 2005 and 2008 to make the last developments in terms of phantom studies and finally cadaver studies. Of course, we had the immense benefit of years of work provided by our colleagues, especially, but not only, in Boston, Brigham and Women's Hospital, the direction of Dr. Yolesh. And then in 2008, we've been able to realize the first series of patients suffering from chronic therapy-resistant neurogenic or neuropathic pain. 12 patients were treated, and this paper is, in fact, presenting the results of this patient group at one-year follow-up.
Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, patients would be very interested in a non-invasive procedure like this. What do you think are some of the other issues or advantages or disadvantages if we compare it to the more traditional techniques in functional neurosurgery like radiofrequency lesioning or deep brain stimulation? How do you think the technology compares to those?
Yes, absolutely. I think first, we can mention the advantages that are general as compared to other possibilities, other treatment options. And they related first to the absence of penetration. Over the centimeters of penetration, if we compare to radio frequency lesioning or deep brain stimulation, we can avoid this centimeter long penetration, which provides more or less trauma to the brain, the possibility, of course, of bleeding on the way to the target, and the infectious risk. These problems are literally eliminated by the new technology. It's also important to mention in this context of non-penetration that the mechanical shift of the brain or target area by the electrode pushing on brain tissue is not negligible and is in fact at the source of the only significant, more than a millimeter, variation of positioning and error due to penetration. This also falls away, providing the possibility to be really placing the work we want to do in a millimeter in all dimensions. These are general advantages, which are already very important. There's another advantage, which is, as far as I know, completely specific to this ultrasound technology, compared, for example, to Gamma Knife, which is also a focusing approach in a similar way. We have here with ultrasound the possibility to use the MR thermometry possibility to, in fact, online, in closed loop, and in real time, monitor and examine and see what we do inside the brain, thanks to these images of thermometry.
So that's a very good point. So I guess this is one of the only neurosurgical procedures where we'd actually watch the or be able to monitor the treatment while it's being delivered.
Yes, yes, and this is absolutely fundamental in terms of safety and precision of the work being done. Yeah, and I think indeed it's the only approach that allows it.
Have you found that the accuracy and precision of MR-guided focused ultrasound is similar or comparable to traditional stereotactic surgery?
Well, we had done years ago, based on our experience with radiofrequency lesioning and electropenetrations, of course, a study detailing the sources of error in such an approach. And at the time, relating to what I just said before, we could indeed describe that we had an accuracy in the mediolateral and anteroposterior dimension inside the millimeter, so as desired, but because of the shift effect, not such a good accuracy in the dorsoventral direction. So it was, if I remember well, 1.7, 1.8 millimeter. So now we have demonstrated, and it's presented in the paper we are discussing today, an accuracy, a mean absolute accuracy inside the millimeter for the three dimensions. As far as I know, it's a very nice precision to be reached.
Yes, this is a very good point. And have you found that since you had the ability to monitor the treatment, did you find that you had to adjust the treatment at all during the course of the procedure?
The possibility to adjust is given here, indeed, because you can then replace your sonication spot according to your ongoing wishes during the treatment. However, the necessity to adjust should in fact be inversely proportional to the accuracy of the targeting procedure using classical SOAR tactic approaches.
Could you summarize for those that are listening in the results of your study? You looked at 11 to 12 patients with fairly severe medication refractory neuropathic pain syndromes.
Yes.
And applied this technology. Could you summarize your findings from the study for us?
Absolutely. We have on this group of patients, in fact, long-term results on a group of 8 to 9 patients, and they all suffered from chronic neurogenic or neuropathic pain, either peripheral origin or central origin. This meaning that the source of the pain is either due to a lesion of a nerve or root or to central lesions. We have also a description and analysis of this pain syndrome using quantitative EEG, which is also presented in the paper. The follow-up are at 3 months and 1 year, and all patients benefited from, as you mentioned before, a central lateral thalamotomy that we might maybe discuss a bit more after. And results are divided in 3 parts. They are the clinical results centered on the 3 months and 1 year follow-ups, and then the quantitative EEG results, and then also a precision analysis I just mentioned before. Precision is inside the millimeter of the three dimension. The quantitative EEG demonstrates a reduction of the so-called thalamocortical dysrhythmia, which is always present by definition in all our patients before treatment, and demonstrates as a group effect a reduction at 3 months already. On the clinical side, we have at 1 year follow-up a mean pain relief of 57% and a reduction of the mean visual analog scale values of the patient of 41%, considering that they are all, as you mentioned, chronically suffering patients with therapy resistance. These results can be considered as being good.
Yeah, very good for that patient population.
Yeah. And another interesting observation is that 6 patients we could observe already present at the moment of the treatment somatosensory improvements that we have already described using the central lateral thalamotomy before.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What was it that they reported?
It happens that in and around the area where neurogenic pain is localized, some elements of hypoesthesia and hypoalgesia can be reduced when the central lateral thalamotomy indeed provides the possibility for the system to come back to a more normal activity. And the 6 patients, if I remember well, practically all mentioned already that they felt better in these body parts during the treatment in parallel with the reduction of the ongoing continuous pain.
That's very interesting. So if they realized an immediate improvement, I guess that was a good prognostic sign for their longer-term follow-up.
Indeed, absolutely. This somatosensory improvement is not always present, is not a must, but if we have both, we feel really that the process of rebalancing the system to a more normal activity is already starting.
You alluded to the quantitative EEG assessments and findings. That was one of the components of the results from this study. I know you have a long history of studying the thalamocortical relationships and their abnormalities with your collaborators at New York University. Could you describe to us what type of EEG findings you find in these people before the treatment and then after the treatment?
Maybe I can exactly now discuss the issue of what is set into this concept of thalamocortical dysrhythmia.
Yeah, that'd be great.
In fact, the whole story of this development was started by Dr. Lenz in 89, who published that in neurogenic pain patients he found bursting activities in the somatosensory specific nucleus of the thalamus. And in 93, we could confirm the presence of these activities broadly distributed in the very special subpart of the medial or non-specific thymus. This bursting activity demonstrated in both experiences a low-frequency discharge rate of exactly locked around 4 Hz. Knowing, based on the data of Poecilinas, that these bursting activity are due to desactivation or so-called also disfacilitation of thalamic cells, and also based on his work then on the whole thalamocortical system, that there is a very close interaction between thalamus and cortex, to the point that we have to speak about the thalamocortical dynamics and thalamocortical units. We then moved into the MEG together in Zurich and New York, and could confirm an increase of activity indeed in the low frequency, around 4 Hz, but also largely distributed in low frequency domain and also in high frequencies. So it came out that we had a picture in this patient of overactivity in low and high frequencies. The mechanism would then be that a desactivation, take the situation of an amputation or phantom limb pain, set the thalamus into a low-frequency activity, which is then very quickly thalamocortical, which then increases a long time, and finally, as last step in this chain reaction, produces an overactivation in high frequencies. If this overactivation happens in the insula or in cingulate areas in pain domains, then the patient may feel pain in the phantom foot. So that's the whole dysrhythmic story. And very interestingly, the area where we found this nest of low-frequency activity in the medial thalamus has a long and very interesting history in our field, Jeff. We have, in fact, if we look back in 1911, Haddon Holmes, neurologist in Queen Square in London, had spoken about, I quote them, an essential medial thalamic center for mechanism of neurogenic pain. And if I could find out correctly, one of the first, if not the first, stereotactic operation done by Spiegel and Weiss in 47 or 49 was, in fact, such a medial thalamotomy.
Mm-hmm.
Along the 50s, it was clear claimed on maybe some small series, but some very interesting too, that operating here, you could get relief, not always, but you could. You did not get any deficit, and you did not produce reactivation of other pain phenomena. That was our red thread, so to say, from 89 to reactualize at anatomical, physiological, and clinical levels this medial thalamotomy story. And our contribution was just to refine which part of the medial thalamus seems to be more central to these dynamics, which is then the central lateral nucleus.
And you were able to distinguish that during open stereotactic cases where you're doing microelectrode recording?
Yes, exactly. And then we could move into non-invasive quantitative EEG analysis, but just looking at the cortical pole of this whole thalamocortical dynamics, providing us now today with quantitative EEG the possibility to diagnose patients clinically and EEG-wise, set indications then on a solid basis, and then follow them up clinically and EEG-wise.
So in your study, the preoperative patients on their quantitative EEG, did they have an abundance of low and high frequencies?
Yes, absolutely correct, yeah.
And that resolved with the thalamotomy procedure?
Yes, exactly. The system moves towards normal. We've published a few years ago the dynamics after treatment with the radio frequency, but we're doing exactly the same with ultrasound, so we expect, and we indeed bring with this paper today, this evidence, it will be the same also with ultrasound, that the system needs time to come back to a more normal activity. At 3 months, and it correlates with the clinical evolution, at 3 months the results clinically, ANG-wise, are on the way, but really beginning. The improvement in EEG are around a third towards normal, and they are much better if the patient got a strong relief, really much better, towards normal at 1 year. We haven't done quantitative analysis at more than 1 year, but it's still possible that some improvements with some restabilization would still take place after 1 year. But the main, no doubt, the system needs at least 1 year to move back towards normal, which is something we may really recognize from the part of a complex system like our thalamocortical system.
It's really amazing that you've been able to correlate the physiological changes as measured on EEG with the clinical improvements in the patients. What do you think is next with this technology or in studying the thalamocortical dysrhythmia syndrome? What are you planning to do next? Is this applicable to other disorders or syndromes?
Yes, there are evidence at both, again, single unit recording level and quantitative EEG levels that what we call globally functional brain disorders might indeed be based on very similar dynamics. In fact, touching different sectors of the thalamocortical system. In 1996 in Brain, we have published at the single unit recording level the evidence of presence of a burst I mentioned before, also in Parkinson's patients and in epilepsy patients and in tinnitus patients, for example. And more recently, we have confirmed, as already mentioned for pain, the presence of an overactivity, so-called dysrhythmia, quantitatively demonstrable in these patients. So there seem to be basic dynamics at the source of different clinical manifestations, a bit in the same way that the powder principle can give you many different fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
So this might open avenues in this direction, with the idea that, in fact, what we probably, on this basis, would think we have to do is to provide the system a way to reduce these overactivities, but very importantly, not reduce the activity of executors. I have to tell you something that is very important. In a complex system, you have always executors that do the function you look at. Let's come back to pain. You have pain executors that are rather focally organized, and you have then regulators. These are sub-areas, some partners of the thalamocortical system that have as a role not to provide pain sensation, but to connect the pain network with all the other ones, which is happening reciprocally all the time. And this is here that the medial thalamus is coming into play, and it is here that the possibility to rebalance the system by specifically going to this, for example, central lateral nucleus, without reducing the activity of the executors. The history of our field is marked by the difficulties if you do that. Coming back again, we produce deficits then by the operation, and we risk to reactivate or rekindle pathological elements. Working on regulators, the risk goes away. This is why, for example, a central lateral thymotomy can be done without any additional problem on both sides,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, you cannot do if you operate in the thalamus in a specific area. So you see how highly relevant, seemingly, the presence of these regulation on all specific parts seem to be.
Yes. Is there anything else that we may have missed?
Yeah, I think we should mention, which is described in the paper, in some details, because it has an important safety measure at hand. The last patient of this series presented a bleeding inside the target. In fact, it extended over 8 to 10 millimeters, and this bleeding, in fact, extruded itself towards the motor thalamus. The bleeding itself in the target would have done nothing additional than the pain relief, but this extension into the motor thalamus produced dysmetria, as expected from an anomaly coming up in the ventral intermedius nucleus, or VLP, and which recovered for the main part over a few days already. The patient at long term at 1 year only keeps difficulties for fine function, mainly speech and handwriting, when he's demanded professionally and personally emotionally. But he recovered subtotally rather fast. But this situation had led us to, in fact, the reason of a stop of our experiment for a certain time, to reanalyze this situation, and two evidence came out. We took the measures to recommend the prevention from any so-called cavitation phenomena inside the brain, using cavitation detectors, and also, very important, there's evidence that we reassessed by a study in 2010 that was realized in Israel by our colleagues there, that there is a no-man's land area for temperatures using ultrasound or any other temperature increases between 60 and 70 degrees. Above 70 degrees, the whole tissue in the target is burned and an extension of the bleeding is suppressed or blocked by it. We see little streaks of blood, but almost extremely rarely. This is our experience with radio frequency and extensive bleeding. Underneath 60 degrees, we have an effect which is very centrally neuronal, which is ideal. And between 60 and 70, there might be a weakening of walls of capillaries in the target that, if there is a blood pressure increase, could lead to a local bleeding. So we have a strong element now to really never move above 60 degrees. This is what we have done in Solothurn, and also what you have done in Charlottesville, and we can touch very good solid wood to think that, as it happened, we didn't have any complication of that sort any longer. I think we may, in fact, even hope that working these conditions, we might come up to have an extremely minimal, extremely low bleeding risk, and this only in millimeters of the target, comparing then very positively to any other techniques.
Yes, theoretically, it should be very safe.
Yes, exactly.
Well, we greatly appreciate you joining us today and congratulate you on a wonderful study that you're able to perform. And good luck to the future studies that you're engaged in.
Yes. And I want also to make the notes that you have also in Charlottesville started beautiful work with exactly the same technology. It's great to be together moving forward with this new technology, and the work you've been providing in the field of essential tremor is a first at all and of greatest quality.
Oh, well, thank you. We really commend you on a really great study and career of work in this area. We're very fortunate to have you with us today. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It was a great pleasure. All the best.
This concludes our podcast for the January issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the February issue, when the topic will be cerebral blood flow.